Congressman Anderson, in the wake of the Afghanistan crisis, President Carter has taken a number of actions which Senator Kennedy has said in the speech put the country in a form of war hysteria. Do you agree?
Mr. Herman, I do believe that in describing the Afghanistan crisis as the gravest since World War II, in some of the statements that have been made by high administration envoys like Clark Clifford, in describing any further moves by the Soviet Union toward the Gulf as one that would bring war, I do believe that the administration has created a climate in this country that has tended to hype the present situation, and I decry it.
From CBS News, Washington, Face the Nation on the CBS Radio Network. A spontaneous and unrehearsed news interview with Representative John Anderson of Illinois, a candidate for the Republican presidential nomination. Representative Anderson will be questioned by CBS News correspondent Mariah McLaughlin, by Carl Lubsdorf, political correspondent for the Baltimore Sun, and by the moderator, CBS News correspondent George Herman.
Congressman Anderson, my problem with understanding exactly where you stand on this question of war, war hysteria, and so forth, is your statement in the, I guess it was the Village Voice interview, where you say, I do go along with the idea that we cannot afford to have the oil pipeline cut. We have to tell the Soviets they cannot sever the oil line. I would not have gone any farther. My problem is understanding how you tell them that they cannot, and yet you don't go any farther. Isn't that kind of an empty warning?
No, I don't think so, Mr. Herman. I think you do it through channels of quiet diplomacy. You don't lay down a so-called Carter Doctrine before you are really sure that you have the kind of strength that is going to be needed in that part of the world to enforce it. What disturbs me, and it goes back to your opening question, a very distinguished student of foreign affairs, George Kennan, said last week that never since World War II has he seen such a militarization of discourse and thought in the U.S. Capitol here in Washington as he has during the past month. And I believe that we have got to realize that despite the threat posed by the Soviet Union, that the door to further negotiations with that country have to remain open. And we have to take the kind of actions, I think, that will show the Soviet Union that even though we thoroughly disapprove of what they've done, and I supported, alone among the Republican candidates, you may recall, I did support the grain embargo. I did support the ban on high technology. I did support a suspension of our participation in the Olympics. But having done that, I think we have to realize that some people, in the very stridency of their approach to that problem, I think are raising the level of danger rather than diminishing it.
Well, in a military sense, though, are there not some steps you feel we ought to take in that region? I mean, such as bases in Pakistan, perhaps, or stepping up our bases in the Indian Ocean?
Mr. Lubsdorf, I have watched with great interest the talk about Pakistan and one story this past week that said that we were preparing to go into an open-ended, long-term military arrangement with that country. I think we ought to proceed very, very carefully. This is an unstable regime in a very unstable part of the world. They are developing a bomb, and apparently with the aid of Libya, one of the certainly less stable countries in the world. And I'm not against short-term aid to Pakistan to shore up their defenses, but to talk about a ground presence, as some have done, to talk about establishing a permanent base there, I believe that we ought to think very long and very hard before we take action of that kind.
Mr. Anderson, do you perceive the Soviet Union's action in Afghanistan as the beginning of, headed for the warm water ports, walking through Iran, taking over oil? Is that what you see? Do you perceive that as this is the beginning, or do you not have enough information to say that?
Well, I don't have enough information. Obviously, I'm familiar with all of the theories that have been voiced about why the Soviets did what they did. It may have been fear of their own Muslim population, some 40 or 50 million. It may have been that they thought that the instabilities in both Afghanistan and Iran might infect their own country. I don't know that it's so important right now that we try to decide perhaps definitely what motivated the Soviet Union. It was, as Mr. Kennan said, it was a very bizarre action for them to take, and I decry it completely. But what I'm also concerned about is that a new Cold War mentality does not settle over this country so totally that we forget the dangers of living in a nuclear age.
Do you think that the present situation has been exaggerated to the point, for example, that we are going to go too far as in defense spending?
Well, we have just had unveiled, of course, a budget that calls for $158 billion in new obligational authority for the Department of Defense. Well, there are always those, of course, who want to spend more, who want to give the military every single gold-plated system that they ask for. I think the question is not whether or not we need 5% a year over the next 5 years that would bring us up to a level of $235 billion by 1985. The better question is, what are we going to get with the money that we spend? Are we really going to get a better balanced, a highly mobile, a lean, taut defense force of the kind that we need? Or are we simply going to trot out some of the plans? The MX missile is one of them that I do not believe will ultimately add to the security of this country.
I'd like to get back, Congressman, to the Middle East, because I'm still not quite clear where and how you think we should draw the line. For example, if the Russians did move into Iran, particularly if that country becomes more unstable than it's been, or into the Persian Gulf, do you think we should oppose them militarily?
Well, obviously, if they were to take military action and roll into Iran in force and occupy that country and thereby gain the ability to choke off the Strait of Hormuz, through which move that 17 million barrels of oil a day to the West, then that would portend some very grave consequences. What I hope the administration is doing, and certainly what they should be doing, is trying to talk to our allies, Japan, Western Europe, and make it clear to them that they have an even more vital interest. 75% of Japan's oil comes from the Middle East. A greater percentage of Western Europe's oil comes from the Middle East than even the United States. And I think we have to be making those collective security arrangements now so that we could respond in appropriate fashion.
Well, that's the problem, appropriate fashion. It's not enough to say portend grave consequences. You have a son of draft age. I have three sons of draft age. You say we cannot afford to have the oil pipeline from the Middle East cut.
True.
Does that mean that we have to put our sons' lives on the line to keep the economy of the United States going?
Mr. Herman, I do not believe that the president, in calling for registration, and I think that means only a prelude, it's only a prelude to resumption of a peacetime draft, was addressing the greatest military need of this country. I do not think we need a peacetime draft. I have stated that I am opposed to registration and the draft. No, I do not believe that it is in that area of manpower that we need to be looking.
But if the president says that if the Soviet Union moves into the Persian Gulf area, there'll be military action if necessary. That's no longer peacetime. That's wartime.
Well, I'm told that it would accelerate perhaps by only 15 days the timetable for getting young men...
No, sir, I think you missed my point. My point is the president right? Should we put the lives, should we take military action, put our children's lives on the line to save the Persian Gulf so the United States can have enough oil to keep its economy booming?
We cannot afford, obviously, Mr. Herman, to permit the industrial paralysis not only of the United States, but the economies of all of Western Europe. And nobody is challenging the concept that we do have vital interests that ought to be protected in that area of the world. But at this time, I think it is highly premature. It is a kind of precipitate action that raises the level of danger in the world rather than lowers it, to be talking in terms of raising vast armies of young men and women.
No, but
here
when
at
you
home.
Say when you say vital interests, that implies that it, sooner or later it may involve lives.
It could. Nobody can rule out that prospect.
And you're willing.
Well, I'm willing to do anything that is necessary to defend the vital interests of this country, to be sure.
But
I'm also equally insistent on the point that to defend the vital interests of this country in the present context, it is not necessary to resume a peacetime draft.
It almost sounds as if you, deep down in your heart, agree with what Mr. Clifford said, but you don't think we should be talking about it that way.
Well, I certainly don't think we should be talking in the terms that Mr. Clifford used in New Delhi a few days ago. All I'm suggesting, Mr. Lubsdorf, and I can only say it, I guess, one way, is that I am willing to defend the vital interests of this country. But I do not regard all of the war talk, all of the semi-hysteria that seems to be gripping certain quarters of official Washington as contributing to the kind of climate that we need to work out a solution to our problems.
I hate to ask this question. If we have a draft, do you think women should go?
Well, as you know, I am a supporter of equal rights for women. I am a supporter of the amendment for that. I voted for and fought for the extension legislation in the last Congress. And I think compatible with that, yes, I think if we have registration, it ought to include women as well as men.
Do you agree with Tip O'Neill's assessment that the House would never go along with the idea of registering or drafting women?
No, I don't believe so, at least as I look back on the votes in the House in favor of the resolution for ERA. It seems to me that he may have overdrawn that a bit.
And then there are some people, some of the women's groups, who are saying that women should not be required to register until ERA is passed.
Well, you could make that point, I suppose. I don't believe that I agree.
On what issue, excuse me, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No.
On what issue, Mr. Anderson, do you feel that you are making most headway in your presidential campaign? Is there one particular issue that you feel is getting a better reception?
Yes. I have tried to convince the people of this country, Mr. Herman, that these are highly unusual times, that the decade ahead is going to pose new challenges that are going to require some sacrifice on the part of the American people, that to stand up and promise, as all of my opponents are doing, that you're going to increase military spending by $20 or $25 billion a year, that you're going to lower taxes as much as 33 1/3%, that at the same time you're going to balance the federal budget, that is the old shell game. I'm also trying to convince audiences across the country that energy is absolutely critical to solving the economic problems of this country. And only if we approach that problem with a willingness to expect some sacrifice on the part of the American people and not engage in the old glib generalities of all the other candidates about produce, 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 without trying to make conservation, a new conservation ethic, really central to our energy program, we simply cannot prevent that drain of more than $70 billion out of this country to pay for imported oil.
I have a question, a tactical question about your presidential campaign. I found any number of people up in New Hampshire last week who said, John Anderson is a good man and we really like him, but he really doesn't have much chance to win, and so therefore, and these were moderate to liberal Republicans, they were saying, we're going to vote for Howard Baker or George Bush. How do you counter that argument?
What I'm going to have to do, I think, is to show that I am the only genuinely moderate candidate among the Republicans in this race. And Mr. Bush's political director said last week, he was quoted in the press last week as saying that we've not addressed the issues through the Iowa caucus. We will now proceed to do so. And when we do, people are going to say, and I quote, they're going to see that this guy is really a conservative. But by that time, we hope all of the moderates will be locked up.
I believe you called him a Ronald Reagan in a Brooks Brothers suit.
Well, Mr. Bush was opposed to the Panama Canal treaties. He was opposed at the time to the recognition of the People's Republic of China. And now, of course, we're busily courting China as an ally. He was opposed to SALT II even before Afghanistan. He's talked about bigger defense budget. He supports the B-1. He supports every single expensive new weapon system, the MX, and still talks about a balanced budget. I do not believe those are moderate views.
How is your campaign doing financially? Do you have any money?
Miss McLaughlin, since the Iowa Forum, when, thanks to the wonders of television, we were able nationwide to bring our candidacy to the American people, we have absolutely had a spectacular rebound in what we've been able to do financially. So, yes, I think we're doing very well.
What kind of treasury do you have now?
Well, we have qualified for matching funds. We will shortly receive our first check, I think, for more than $300,000. And with the monies that we have already raised, we're still under $1 million. We are still a low-budget candidate of all those in the race. We don't have $4.5 million or $10 million as some of the others do. But we are going to have the funds, I believe, to compete effectively in the early New England primaries.
Some of that money comes, does it not, from Democrats. Isn't that part of your problem, that when you talk about yourself as a moderate, you're very appealing to the Democrats, but not so appealing to the, how would I call it, the vast Republican electorate?
Mr. Herman, I think the issues are so important today that we ought to build a new coalition of voters, and we ought to do it in the nominating process. Every one of these other candidates that are running against me claim that they can get Democratic votes in the fall if they are nominated. I'm proving right now in the primaries, in the nominating process, that I can do that. I think we need a new coalition in this country of Democrats, independents, and Republicans who think that the issues are too important to just confine the nominating process to the same old narrow political aspect that it's had before.
That's a nice theory, but can it get you any kind of a strong vote in New Hampshire or Massachusetts?
Well, I believe it can, because I've talked to many people in both of those states in the last few weeks that have said for the first time in their lives they're going to be voting in a Republican primary to assist my candidacy.
These are Democrats, I take it.
Democrats and independents. In the last week, I've been on the campus of four or five institutions, colleges and universities in New England. I've talked to almost 5,000 students, and I have never seen the kind of enthusiasm for my candidacy that I saw among those young people.
Well, of course, students are notoriously enthusiastic about candidates, and then they don't vote very much. So isn't that a sort of a frail thing to base a candidacy on?
No, it isn't, because they're going to provide the bulk of the volunteer force that we're using to canvass the electorate in those two states. We're getting busloads of those students to help us to go from Massachusetts up to New Hampshire, and I think that they can be a very, very healthy and exciting element in our campaign.
Mr. Anderson, if you get the nomination right now, who would you say would be your Democratic opponent?
Well, you know, it would be very tempting to suggest that on the basis of what happened in Iowa, that it's naturally going to be President Carter. I happen to believe that despite the polls, which are going to prove to be the most volatile in the history of polling, it's very, very early and therefore very speculative to try to determine who the Democratic nominee is going to be. I would admit that that Mr. Carter is using the powers of the incumbency very, very effectively.
Wouldn't it be to your advantage, actually, for Senator Kennedy to do poorly in, say, Maine and New Hampshire, so that in Massachusetts you might be able to pick up the support of a lot of independents who are more liberal and might otherwise vote for Senator Kennedy? Wouldn't that help your candidacy if he falls even further?
Oh, Mr. Lubsdorf, you could make that argument, but he isn't going to need the help from independents in Massachusetts. That's his home state. He's been successfully elected there a number of times to the Senate, and I'm urging the independents to get into the race, get into the election, and vote in the primary in which I'm entered, because I'm the one who really needs the help in that state, and there's where their vote can really make the difference.
Getting back to your statement about President Carter and how volatile the polls are, do you expect any impact on the polls of the revelations about Secretary of the Treasury G. William Miller and the Textron Corporation? Do you think that for the good of the president's campaign, it would be better if Mr. Miller resigned?
Well, I've noted that Senator Proxmire, of course, is in the process of deciding whether or not the Senate committee should hold hearings on that. He voted against his confirmation, I believe, because of those charges. And I have also noted that Mr. Carter has now publicly said he will not expect the resignation, or will not ask for the resignation of Mr. Miller. Yes, it could make a difference. It could make a difference.
Do you believe that President Carter is really a captive in the Rose Garden, or do you think he could go out and campaign and not demoralize the country and fracture the country?
Well, Ms. McLaughlin, you remember that back when President Carter was 36 points behind in the polls, he was still willing to debate. And this was after the 4th of November when the embassy was seized. It was only when the polls then showed this total reversal and showed him on top that he then went back to the oldest of political maxims: never debate your opponent as long as you're ahead. That's the old politics, and I agree with those who say that a president should expose his policies to the forum of free and open debate. And I have some sympathy for his Democratic rivals who can't seem to get him out of the White House to do that. I think we as Republicans would like to hear the president defend these policies in the forum of a debate, and I do believe that the some small suspicion attends the idea that, it leads me to think that he may be avoiding that debate because he's just practicing the old politics.
Congressman Anderson, Mr. Herman mentioned before the fact that you were getting some sympathetic support from Democrats as well as independents.
Yeah.
How seriously have you thought of the possibility that if you do not win the Republican nomination, that you might run as an independent in fall?
Well, it seems to me that anyone who looks at the various state election laws and the timetable for doing that realizes that by the time of the Democratic and Republican conventions, there would scarcely be time to mount a credible independent candidacy.
Let me turn your attention in another direction. You're a member of the House of Representatives. The newspapers and the airwaves are today just filled with stories about what you might call the sting, the FBI's television recordings of various members of the government accepting money to further some legislation. How do you feel about this? Do you feel there's some bit of entrapment in this? Is this a proper, legitimate function of the FBI to investigate the Congress in this fashion?
Well, I don't think that any institution of government is above investigation. I was one of those who very early on went over and testified against the notion that Mr. Kleindienst and Mr. Nixon once had about executive privilege being invoked for everybody in the executive branch. No, Congress has to be able to stand the test of public scrutiny and investigation like any other department of our government. And I'm deeply pained at what has been published. Of course, it hasn't been presented to a grand jury. It's too early to make any evaluation of those charges, but I would not exempt Congress from the very closest scrutiny.
Do you feel there's any smell of entrapment about it?
I don't know enough about it. I've just read the stories, and I just simply could not comment on it.
Congressman Anderson, we may not have quite enough time for you to give a full answer to this, but I've often wondered, you came to Congress as a fairly conventional Midwestern conservative and had a rather conservative voting record from the start. You've gradually become more moderate and more liberal. How does that happen?
Oh, I think it's a process of maturation, Mr. Lubsdorf. I was here in Washington during two of the most difficult, traumatic decades in the history of the Republic. And certainly feeling as I did some of the pain of the civil strife that went on in this country over civil rights, realizing that we were in danger of becoming two societies, two separate societies, one black and one white, seeing the rioting in the streets over the question of Vietnam and our participation in that war, all of those things I think have taught me a great deal. And sure, some of my ideas have changed. I think my basic qualifications as a member of my party are still there, but I would hope that any man who's had the experiences that I have had would grow in the process.
But your party is still pretty conservative, is it not?
Well, it is, but I believe that with the kind of coalition of voters that I can attract in this campaign, I can demonstrate that I am clearly the one candidate that they can hope to elect in November of 1980.
Thank you very much, Congressman Anderson. And we'll have a word about next week's guest in a moment.
Today on Face the Nation, Representative John Anderson of Illinois, a candidate for the Republican presidential nomination, was interviewed by CBS News correspondent Mariah McLaughlin, by Carl Lubsdorf, political correspondent for the Baltimore Sun, and by the moderator, CBS News correspondent George Herman. Next week, Senator Edward Kennedy, a candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination, will face the nation. This broadcast was recorded earlier today in Washington and was edited to conform to time requirements. It was produced by Joan Barone and Mary Yates and directed by Robert Vitarelli. Face the Nation is a production of CBS News. This is the CBS Radio Network.